On this episode of Skeptico, Robert McLuhan discusses his book, Randi's Prize.
We complain an awful lot, don't we, about people like James Randi and apparently sort of subverting what seems to be perfectly good data and sort of rather deceptively distorting perceptions and so on. And we complain about that a great deal. But I think we have to sort of start thinking beyond that and thinking, well, you know, what is it exactly that these guys are trying to protect? Is that perhaps a rational thing that they're doing? Perhaps I can make the point a bit more succinctly. If you think about psychokinesis, just imagine the effect of science declaring that psychokinesis is real. If you really think this right through, we are in a very changed environment. And if we are starting to say that human minds can interact with matter.
I agree, but I don't think it comes anywhere near to the revolution that it takes to say that consciousness survives death. I mean, as soon as we say consciousness survives death, I think everything pales in comparison. So we can move objects with our mind. Who cares? What is our mind? Where does our mind reside? What is us?
Sorry, I completely disagree about that because I'm not sure if you get the point. Because, you know, when we die, yes, you're absolutely right. That's hugely important and, yes, you know, huge implications for us as individuals. But the fact is, we don't really know until we die whether that's going to happen or not. And it's not actually making a huge difference to human society. But it will make a huge difference to human society if we think that some people can hex other people or, you know, interfere with the brakes when they're driving, that sort of thing. See, it doesn't even have to be true. But if science says that something like that actually is feasible and possible and might happen, then what sort of situation are we in?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to take a look at the skeptical movement and the skeptical community, which in some ways we talk about a lot on Skeptico, but in other ways we never really look at the skeptical community in whole, and in particular some of the key figures like James Randi. We really don't do that very much. We talk around about the issues. But today we're going to step back from that a little bit with the author of a new book entitled Randi's Prize. And while Rob McLuhan's book really has a broader scope than just James Randi, it really gets to this issue of the role the skeptical community has played and maybe some of the reasons behind it. Here's my interview with Rob McLuhan. Robert McLuhan is an Oxford-trained freelance journalist who's authored Randi's Prize, What Skeptics Say About the Paranormal, Why They're Wrong, and Why It Matters. Robert, welcome to Skeptico.
Thanks, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too. Thanks for joining me. You've written an interesting book here that really goes way beyond James Randi and sets out the whole argument for paranormal effects like psi and near-death experience and so many of the things that we've talked so much about here on Skeptico. So let's start by talking about the argument that supports the claim for the paranormal, and why the gravitational pull of orthodoxy, as you say, means that all those claims might not matter anyway. What is the argument for the paranormal?
I mean, what I was trying to say there, I came up with this term rational gravity, and by that I meant the sort of pull, yeah, exactly, the pull of orthodoxy. It's a psychological process. You know, we're used to the world working in certain ways. That's our everyday reality. And when something comes along that doesn't fit with that reality, then I suspect there's a psychological process that kicks in. In many cases, not in all, but some people will unconsciously find some way of resolving the dilemma posed by this apparent anomaly. And in the process of doing that, they will come up with all sorts of explanations. And having arrived at explanations of, you know, what's happened or what somebody's claimed, no matter how speculative it may be, they will feel that the whole matter's been resolved successfully and they don't have to think about it anymore. And I think that that's a process that one sees going on quite a lot in the skeptical community.
Right, because you think the evidence that you lay out in the book is actually quite strong, at least in some areas, right?
Well, I do, yes. I think how one responds to it is very much a question of temperament. Take something like telepathy. Personally, I'm not particularly fazed by the idea. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't frighten me. I'm intrigued about it, curious about it, but I don't automatically think that something like that is impossible and could never happen. I want to see evidence of it. But I think there are people who find something like that really pretty difficult to deal with. And that's absolutely fair enough. I mean, you think about, people messing with your head. That's the ultimate schizophrenic paranoid nightmare. So, of course, some people are going to be upset by that and try and explain it away. But ultimately, I see this in terms of a sort of... in the same terms as I see politics. I think that people identify with different positions, different points of view, according to their temperament, their background perhaps, the circumstances they're in. All of these things shape their attitudes to political ideas, ideologies. And at the bottom, it's a sense of, what kind of world do we want this to be? What kind of world do I want to live in? What is it that makes me feel comfortable? And then trying to make that world come about. And I see the same process happening in this argument with psychic phenomena. Some people accept it and go with it, and others resist it.
I think that's so true, but I think most people would find that utterly unbelievable, remarkable, fantastic to even comprehend, because we all walk into this thinking, hey, science doesn't work like that. Oh, I know politics works like that, but science doesn't work like that. And that's what I thought was one of the intriguing things about your book and about the approach, but it almost starts at second base with this idea that skepticism is a part of science, And I had the most interesting interview a while back. I don't know if you caught it, but it was with Dr. Peter Bancel, who's the guy who's worked on the Global Consciousness Project, and he's from France. And he really kind of changed my whole view on this thing when he said, I don't really see science as being about skepticism at all. Science is about asking questions and asking the best questions you can. If those questions happen to be skeptical in nature, fine, but it's really not about skepticism. And that skepticism is really about this idea, like you were saying, about winning votes in the court of public opinion, and that that somehow co-opted our notion that that is really what science is. And so I wonder how that ties back to what you're saying. Is science really about winning these political battles about what things really...
You listen to scientists talking and they say exactly that. I mean, they do say that actually, this is a little secret and not many people outside the scientific community realize this, that actually science is a very messy business. And in lots of cases, it's the people who shout loudest, the people who, create the biggest, the strongest lobbies around the evidence, obviously. But, there is a big tug of war, a sort of free-for-all going on around all sorts of controversial subjects within science. The outcome of that is obviously what's important, because eventually it settles down and the consensus is reached. It just happens that in this case, rather uniquely, I think, it's not just a matter of science, it's a matter of popular culture. And that's because psychic experiences actually originate with people. It's a consciousness thing. And I think that's something that science finds rather difficult to deal with.
I think that's a great point. And I wonder if that's the other little dirty secret in science, or the part that isn't publicly discussed. And that's that science is totally immersed in our culture and in these culture war issues that keep rising to the surface. And one of the things that really kind of gets to me is when we kind of paper that over and we say, no, science is above that. Science is different. Gosh, no. I mean, if anything, in every area you want to look at, whether you want to look at psychic phenomena or whether you want to look at climatology or anything, I mean, it is totally immersed in our culture. How do we get out of that to really get a better handle on what's really going on?
Yeah, and I think actually that's the skeptic's big complaint is, they come to the data looking for really hardcore results, something black and white, such as I understand it, one would find in physics and chemistry, but there aren't any sort of gray shades. But of course, psi is, as a result of consciousness, is right at the other end of the spectrum. It's at the end of an enormously complex chain of biological events. And it is very hard to pin down in that way. But I think it's up to people like us to try and, you know, untangle these issues and present them clearly and as articulately as we can, so that the public and scientists themselves, who may not know very much about these issues, can understand them better and a better place to make a judgment.
Tell us a little bit about how you set out to do that in your book, Randy's Prize.
Yeah, okay. Well, this goes back quite a way now, because I started to write this book in the mid-90s, and it came about because I was reading a lot of science books. And it was only then that I really understood for the first time just how completely science appears to reject any idea of spirit, of soul, of psychic communication, all these things. Things which I, until that moment, hadn't had any sort of very particular strong view on, but which I remained open-minded about. And I thought, well, hang on, you know, these guys really know what they're talking about, so this is something that I ought to investigate. So I started going to libraries, looking at books. I found the Society for Psychical Research, huge collection of research, going right back to the 1880s. And this was a huge surprise to me. I had no idea that all this stuff was out there. So I started a process of reading both sides, looking carefully at what the skeptics were saying, looking at the studies by the psychic researchers, and trying to make some sense of it, and actually failing for the longest time. But after about two and a half years, it sort of started to become clear to me, just simply by dint of hard work and hard study, that the skeptics really didn't have a handle on it. They were actually coming to it with you know, with speculations rather than actual research.
The analogy that I drew in the last episode, and it really was similar to you, in that, you know, after banging on it for the longest time, it kind of struck me, it's really apologetics. It's really analogous to Christian apologetics, where they use logic and reason, but you know where the story is going to end. You know, it's like a child's book.
I hear you. I hear you, and you know, I sometimes feel that way myself. But actually, at that time, I really was taking the skeptics very seriously indeed, and it was very difficult for me, because, you know, I was just going ding dong, ding dong. You know, I'd read the skeptics and I think, God, these guys really, yeah, of course it was a trick, and that's how he did it. You know, and then I'd read the researching, and I think, well, hang on, you know, there's a lot of detail here. It's not quite as clear as all that. And it was very difficult to come to a decision about it. But having done that, you see, having done it, I actually wrote the book. I did actually get an agent, a literary agent, and he hawked it around, and nobody was interested, so that was pretty much the end of that. But when I thought about it, I thought, well, what I've done is I've written a study of psychic research, of parapsychology. But who cares? Because parapsychology is not accepted as a serious scientific subject. That book will only ever appeal to people who know something about these issues, and probably my knowledge about it is not going to add very much to theirs. So really, I've been wasting my time. And then I thought, well, you know, what is the job here? It's to try to find some way of getting across the complexity of this problem to a wider public, to explain to them that the reason the paranormal is so controversial, and there are all sorts of reasons, and to try to make them understand, you know, the psychological issues and the social issues, as well as the scientific issues. And then I thought, well, really the best way to do this is to try and present it as my own journey, just to go back in time and write an account of how I, you know, compared the two sides together, and make my thinking as transparent as possible, so that people can see my reasoning. They can see why. First of all, I thought the skeptics really had it nailed, and then I wasn't so sure. And then finally, I understood where the truth lay. And I thought that, if one could try to do that, then, you know, hopefully it might become a little bit clearer.
Did it become any clearer for you in terms of what the real journey is about? Because I think one of the most fascinating parts of the whole situation that we're in with regard to this science, this breakthrough science of consciousness and what it might mean, is the social phenomena. You know, it really isn't about, and we both have been saying this during this interview from the very beginning, the deeper I get into it, the more and more I realize it's really not about the data. It's really not about the evidence. It's really about all these other influences that are going on. And so do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I try to sort of sum this up at the end of the book. I sort of spend a little bit of time thinking about all the different issues. And I mentioned that, you know, I had a friend, and I was talking to her about all this stuff quite an early stage. And she just suddenly exclaimed, and she was interested, but she just suddenly said, but, you know, Rob, if this stuff is true, why isn't it known? You know, why don't we accept it? Why don't scientists say it's, you know, it's all okay, it's true? You know, surely the fact that science says it isn't true must mean something. And when I started to think about it, I realized there are very deep issues here. I mean, you know, we touched on the psychology of it, and I do think that, as I say, I do think that some people are resistant to it, and I think there's quite a lot of evidence in the literature about this. But, you know, if you look a bit further beyond it, you have to ask the question, if it's true, what kind of world are we living in? And how is that going to change our perceptions? Would happen if science, let's take the example of Randi's prize. I mean, what would happen if James Randi suddenly popped up one day and said, you know, I've tested this person, and guess what? He's the real deal. You know, there is such a thing as psychism. Now, actually, in parenthesis, I don't think this would make the slightest difference. I think that, you know, skeptics would just say, oh, well, that James Randi's lost it, poor chap, you know. I think they'd find all sorts of ways of, as they always do, of explaining it away. But I think it would be a different matter if scientists as a body were to start talking about psi in halfway sympathetic terms and saying, yes, actually, on consideration, we do think there may be something happening here. Now, I'm not thinking about the effect on science, which I obviously would be quite dramatic. I'm thinking about the effect, the wider effect on society.
Right. Well, you know, let me interject something. One of the things that really kind of sparks me, sets me off, is when folks say that the implications for science wouldn't be that dramatic, you know, and science would basically go on as it has before. And I think that's not only a naive view, but a view that gets to the social part of it that just we're totally glossing over. And maybe that's what you're alluding to. I mean, Western culture, as we know it, is built on some ideas that are fundamentally at odds with the notion that consciousness survives death, that consciousness is separate from body.
Exactly. It's secularity. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, I always think of this sort of seminal moment in 1660 when the Royal Society was founded. And, you know, it was just a few scientists getting together and saying, look, I mean, there was absolute mayhem going on in the world outside. I mean, the most ghastly things, wars, civil wars, most of them based around religion. And this was a time when just a few clear-headed people came together and said, look, let's put all this stuff aside and, you know, let's see how the world really works. You know, we'll check our religion at the door and all those opinions. We won't argue about that stuff. And that, to me, you know, was an extraordinary moment. From that, the Enlightenment came about, and the development of secular thinking. And with it, of course, democracy and popular government. Now, I think that, you know, we can't really turn our backs on the idea that we have something very precious there. And whether we're religious or not, there has to be a space where we all come together and say, you know, we have common goals, common ideas, and we're not going to let our sort of tribal religious ideas get in the way. We have to do that because otherwise we might not have democracy as we know it today. And that's why I think that, you know, religion and politics do tie up very closely. And Psi, of course, does have rather strong religious implications. So if, as I say, science was suddenly to say, yes, we think Psi is real, then this rather opens the way to a survivalist interpretation. And suddenly we have science seemingly endorsing some form of religion. The complicating factor is that it's one kind of religion and not another. And suddenly we've lost that space that secular space, that thing in common that we all had, that sort of default position. And we're now in a completely different situation. And I think that, looking forward 100 years maybe, something like that might come about, and that really would cause a revolution.
But I'm not sure. I was with you there for a minute, Robert, but I'm not quite sure what you're really advocating there, that we need to stay within the confines of the society and structure that we've built in terms of our political structure and our... And I'm also not quite sure what you mean that this idea of consciousness would favor a particular religion. Maybe you can expound on those two aspects.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, no, these are difficult questions. And as I say, I've touched on it in the book, but it's perhaps a little bit hard to get across in a couple of sentences. I think that Psy shades into spiritualism. If you're talking about mediums, and if you're investigating mediums, and you say, yes, these guys have some ability to certainly to tap into other people's minds, and beyond that, the possibility of tapping into the minds of dead people, straight away you're starting to create a religious framework. And spiritualism is a very particular ideology. It is not at all, it's not very easily harmonized with traditional Christianity. So you have a situation in which science, having supported secularity, now appears to be endorsing a form of spiritualism. I think this would be, this would raise pretty serious issues.
Agreed. But where I was going and where I really wanted to understand better what you're saying is that I think the way it fundamentally shifts Western society in general is, as you were kind of alluding to in the kind of history, broad strokes of history there, we're built on this idea of these separate states. We're built on the idea that we are separate entities, of course, but we're also built that we have these separate economic interests and that we trade and we do these things and we have this kind of tribal mentality. And if the science is as it appears, then we really have to rethink those at a very deep level. I mean, we are no longer, this separateness goes away. I mean, that's one of the things we learn right away. And so...
Sorry, you're talking about separateness as individuals.
And separateness as tribal groups, as separate states. I think that's just a small leap. I think the links between materialism and materialism are there too, in terms of consumerism and what we consume versus... And this idea. So, I mean, I think these notions run very, very, very deep, and yet we never really get to those conversations. And what I thought was so... What I thought was so interesting, and what I thought you were alluding to there for a minute, is that those are the conversations people really want to have, is that do we want to make the decision, even if it is true, do we want to follow the data there, or is that way too unsettling, and we don't really even want to go there? Right now, it isn't a conscious decision, but maybe it should be a conscious decision.
Yeah, no, exactly. I agree completely. And I think that's why it's important to start talking about these things. I mean, you said start a conversation. That is absolutely my idea. I think there are things we need to talk about here, because we complain an awful lot, don't we, about people like James Randi and apparently sort of in a rather opportunistic way, subverting what seems to be perfectly good data and sort of rather deceptively distorting perceptions and so on. And we complain about that a great deal. That's been going on since 1880. But I think we have to sort of start thinking beyond that and thinking, well, what is it exactly that these guys are trying to protect? Is that perhaps a rational thing that they're doing?
What do you think?
I think there's a I think we'd have to take that into account. I really do. Just a very small thing I'd like to raise I was talking about Psy and religion, and that's a rather large subject to get into a small space. But perhaps I can make the point a bit more succinctly in terms of superstition as a sort of a general entity. If you think about psychokinesis, just imagine the effect of science declaring that psychokinesis is real. If you really think this right through, You really have to see that we are in a very changed environment. And if we are starting to say that human minds can interact with matter, then that raises all sorts of very difficult implications.
I agree, but I don't think it comes anywhere near to the revolution that it takes to say that consciousness survives death. I mean, as soon as we say consciousness survives death, I think everything pales in comparison. So we can move objects with our mind. Who cares? What is our mind? Where does our mind reside? What is us? You know, where have we been?
No, all right. No, sorry. I completely disagree about that because I'm not sure if you get the point. Because, you know, when we die, yes, you're absolutely right. That's hugely important and, yes, you know, huge implications for us as individuals. But the fact is, we don't really know until we die whether that's going to happen or not, and it's not actually making a huge difference to human society. But it will make a huge difference to human society if we think that some people can hex other people, can cause. I think Stephen Browdy has a good phrase here to cause a despised co-worker's computer to crash, or to cause somebody a migraine. I mean, these are very small things, but you know, interfere with the brakes when they're driving, that sort of thing. See, it doesn't even have to be true. But if science says that something like that actually is feasible and possible and might happen, then what sort of situation are we in? And I suspect, and I'm not sure if this is a, you know, this is a conscious idea that skeptics have, and I don't recall them talking about it particularly.
I think we are giving them way too much credit, but go ahead.
Yeah, perhaps. I think that's something that sooner or later will have to come up, and yes, we will have. I think, you know, what I'm trying to say in a nutshell is, Alex, we have to think about the implications, the wider implications of psi. Or rather the wider implications of psi endorsed and accepted by a central authority like science.
Right, and I don't want to go too far down this path because we already have. It's fascinating, but we could do 5 hours on this and most people would be not that interested. But it seems to me that the crux of your argument is that we somehow needed to hold the fabric of this society that we have together, which is fine. Now, that's a very interesting point. But my point was that I think some of the science questions the fundamental underlying assumptions we have about why we would form a society the way that we have. So it would challenge the whole notion of, you know, you're saying, gee, society as we know it would fall apart. And I think a logical stream that you could take near-death experience science is to say, we've totally got society wrong in terms of how we've constructed it. So a total reset on the reset button is something that we should start with rather than say, how do we keep this little engine going that we already have.
I completely agree, and of course that is the obverse of what I've been saying. I think the way I've been talking is in the context of skeptical responses to paranormal claims. You know, because as I say, you know, we've talked about it lots of times here on Skeptico, that, you know, skeptics do come up with all sorts of distortions, which, you know, seem frankly unfair. But, you know, I think we've got to stop complaining about it and actually start thinking about things from the skeptic's point of view. I mean, what is it that frightens them about it so much?
I think that's just a fascinating point. I'm so glad we went there. And you mentioned James Randi again just a minute ago. And I want to come back to James Randi because I know there's a lot of folks who are going to tune into your book, flip it open, and expect to see a lot about James Randi. You don't really have a lot about him in there.
No.
But by the same token, I think he's worth talking about in this context because he really is a fascinating character, and he really is, by his own making, he's really right in the middle of this whole thing we're talking about. What's your take on James Randi?
James Randi, difficult question. I mean, I did anticipate your remark, and in fact, I have sort of tried to preempt it a little by pointing out that, you know, the book isn't really about James Randi. I mean, it's... you know, the title for me, Randi's Prize, I mean, I just thought that was a cool image for the whole, you know, for the whole debate, the whole controversy. Because, I mean, Randi's Prize in scientific circles actually means something. I just took it as a sort of an image for the controversy generally. But there is another point to make here, and that is that actually, I think a book about James Randi, would it be that interesting? I think it would be interesting to those of us who know quite a lot about the subject. I think perhaps you could put a book together about, James Randi's adventures and his, various interactions and all the extreme. He's a funny guy, and, you could get all sorts of mileage out of that. But, a book like that's only really going to be interesting to people who know about James Randi, and I'm not really interested in that. I'm not interested in preaching to the converted. I mean, I hope very much that, people...
But hold it, Robert, because there's a whole other angle here that really does get to the heart of what your book is about, and that's why skeptics believe what they do. And I think we have to be very careful when we use the term skeptic, because as you alluded to earlier, in that they're kind of the advance guard to society and the fabric of society that holds it together. I mean, that's way a stretch for me, but that's where we were going before. They are also the advance guard, the bulldog on a chain for science in general. So when I talk about skeptics, I'm not talking about some group of weird guys who meet once a year in London and in Las Vegas. I think far from that. I think they are really front and center for mainstream science. They're the guys who are out there espousing these ideas so other people can take cover and say, I don't really have to deal with that stuff. And in that way, I think looking at James Randi and looking at the phenomenon of James Randi is central to what you're talking about. So I do want to go there.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, I mean, I wouldn't want to give the impression I haven't written anything about James Randi. In fact, he features quite a lot in the book. Of course he does. He's one of the main guys. But I what I'm trying to do is put it in a larger context, because, if you're going to understand James Randi, you've got to understand the issues, and it was really the issues that my book is about.
Right. Well, here's what you wrote to me in the email. My view of Randi is that he's a conjurer doing whatever it takes to create illusions and opportunistically manipulating circumstances to his end. No question he makes stuff up. Now, that's what you said, and that is the truth. I mean, that's what the record says to anyone who looks at it.
I'm fascinated by James Randi. It has to be said, I am. He's a phenomenon in all sorts of ways. But I think one of the things especially that I puzzled about for a long time is what it is that makes magicians in particular extremely upset about paranormal claims. And when I thought about this, I pushed it a bit and came up with some quite interesting conclusions. Magicians are, conjurers are always talking about how easy it is to deceive people. It's all about deception, about distraction. And they will say, that is half the conjurer's art. Once you know how to distract people, then you can do all kinds of stuff. And it's the fact that people, anybody can be distracted, can be deceived, that makes stage magic possible. And I just wondered whether this is something that magicians are actually doing.
Well, but hold on, Robert, because all that might have been true way back at the very beginning, at the earliest phases of how Randi and some of these other folks approached it. But we really can't go there anymore. And, from the little quote of yours that I played, I think the part that is just plain out there that we have to address is that no question he makes stuff up, because there is no question he makes stuff up. But the important point for our discussion here is that the people inside of his organization, very few people know that. People are surprised by that. I'll give you an example, and this will take a minute, but a couple weeks ago, I published an episode of Skeptico, and I played an audio clip from a very old video done by Stanford Research Institute, where they had done some ESP experiments with Uri Geller. And these were pretty fantastic experiments.
Is this what Targan
put off, right? So I presented these, and I put it out there, and hey, right away I got a response on my website saying, hey, you know what? You really missed the point here, because all this stuff was debunked by Randi in his book Flim Flam, and he debunked all these experiments. Now, what's so fascinating is, so we got to get into a little bit of the details here, but one of the main ways that he debunked it is Randi claims that the cameraman for these experiments, a guy named Pressman, has come out and said, hey, these were faked. I didn't shoot all this video, and therefore we can't trust these experiments. Well, someone finally went and investigated whether that claim is true, and it was completely false. Mm. Targan put up, said, here, I have an affidavit from Pressman. He says he did record every bit of the video.
Yeah.
And then somebody finally called up Pressman, and he said, that's an outrageous claim. It's totally fabricated. Yes, all that video you see was shot by me.
Yeah.
So, but here's the point. here's the point in all that. Not that Randy lied, but he did. But when you present that evidence, like I did, to a skeptic, to a Randy supporter, they're impervious to it. They're like, well, that doesn't matter. And one of the things they say is, well, Randy's done so many good things. Randy's done so many good things. Can't we allow him a foul up here or there? And I mean, that just is the beginning of the list of kind of misdeeds of James Randi. So the interesting part from this aspect of where you're handling this is, what is it about our need or the need among this group to so desperately believe? It really is almost like a religious kind of fervor that they get, and a need to, you know, even when you present some really obvious stuff, they just can't go there. They have to stand behind those 6-foot images he has of himself at these conferences. I mean, there are some very cultish aspects to it. Not that there aren't some very cultish aspects to other aspects of our society. I mean, religion is certainly very cultish. But I mean, how do we sort all that out in terms of what's really going on?
Okay,
there?
Right. Well, I think it's up to people like us to talk about these things and make them clear. I mean, I used to feel the same way. I sort of feel frustrated and irritated the way that, you know, perfectly good data is just, I mean, you know, the business about JT and, you know, Richard Wiseman and Rupert Sheldrake and the dog JT, I mean, you know, that sort of controversy. I mean, it's terribly, you know, it's really extraordinary how easy it is to debunk something without really knowing very much about it, and so simply to change perceptions. But I'm sort of becoming more optimistic because, I'm thinking that, I mean, James Randi is coming to the end of his career now, and, you know, I'm not sure if we're going to see his like again. And I think he really grew out of a reaction in the late 1970s, early 1980s, a sort of a reaction to perhaps the rather sort of uncritical enthusiasm about science, psychic research that perhaps came out of the 60s and with Uri Geller and so on and so on. And I think these guys, Randi, Paul Kurtz, the founder of PsyCop, the CSI now, you know, these guys are, I think they, as I say, they're coming to the end of their careers, and I think they've had a good innings, and I think they've had quite a lot of effect. And I think really it's time for, you know, people like ourselves, as you, as Chris Carter, Michael Prescott, Greg Taylor at the Daily Grail, and other people as well, just quietly making these points. And I think, you know, sooner or later we may achieve some critical mass, and, you know, perhaps some scientists will start to say, well, yes, you know, perhaps we should reconsider these things.
Why would that happen? I just don't buy into that, Robert. I think that gets me really worked up. That seems to me dangerous thinking. I mean, go back. You have some great cases in your book. Go back to the turn of the century. Was the evidence any less overwhelming? Were the researchers any less qualified to report on that evidence? I think we go back to the first quote that I mentioned, you know, the gravitational pull of orthodoxy. And I think we make a big mistake if we underestimate the gravitational pull to keep things the way they are. And this idea to just characterize Randi is just this kind of goofy old man magician who's going to pass away and then everything's going to die down. No way.
No. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it in quite that way. I think the point I'm making is that yes, there's been a lot of evidence, but I think if we rely on the science to try and without putting it in some kind of context, then we'll never make any progress. But if we can put it into context, if we can show the psychological factors in the way that the skeptical community behaves, as you've described, if we can put it in the context of the social factors. You know, the terms of what kind of society would be if Psy was acknowledged to be real, then we can start to see, you know, the pressure, we can start to see the outlines of the ideological war going on here. I am optimistic. I think perhaps, because we're not, nobody's trying to convince the skeptics. I think this is, we're making a big mistake if we think that we can, you know, just by talking to them, we can change their minds. That's not going to happen. This is why I say it's politics. You know, when the in the British House of Commons, the Conservatives get up and yell at the Labour on the other side, shouting at each other and so on. They're not trying to convince each other. They're trying to influence public opinion. And I think that's what we should be doing.
I'm not so sure. I mean, one of the things that I've found from doing Skeptico is that there really are a lot of people in the middle. There really are folks who are in a process of trying to understand this information, and they're trying to come. You had another quote in your book about the vacancy of the New Age thinking, you know, and how it's really intellectually vacant. And I think that we could also say that about a lot of religious thought that gets thrown around. You know, it doesn't have a lot of meat to it for someone who wants to approach the topic intellectually. So I think there's a lot of folks that come into this in the same way that you did, in the skeptical message is very appealing because it buys into something they've already discovered that, hey, there's a lot of bunk out there that I have to sort through. But I think there's a lot of people that are in that middle ground then who are open to, hey, you know what? This doesn't quite ring true either. And as I alluded to, they're surprised when they find out that Randy does make this stuff up and that Randy is playing a game on them in the same way that religion was trying to play a game on them.
But doesn't that exactly reinforce my point? You know, because you're banging your drum here, as other people are. You know, we're making these points and we're influencing their opinions. We're helping them to see something that otherwise they might not.
Right. Maybe I was reacting too much to the idea that we shouldn't be arguing with the skeptics or we shouldn't be. I think we need to have a certain respect for folks who are willing to engage in the first place on these topics. And yeah. I think there's a lot of room to engage with skeptics and to really find a way to talk about these things in a meaningful way. So, you know, this idea that we can't convince a skeptic, I think, is not a starting point. It's not a starting point for me. And I just move away from that position.
I'm interested in this. I mean, do you actually think you could change a skeptic's mind?
I think everyone who is a quote-unquote believer, I'm a believer, was once a skeptic.
Yes.
So I think it's kind of a tautology. Of course, I don't know if you or I can do it, but I think there's a process that they go through. And I think that, you know, and there's certainly, I don't want to make it like it's a, you know, there's plenty of believers who are now skeptics too. So, you know, it kind of goes both ways.
But no, I was thinking more of, you know, the skeptic spokesman, you know, the psychop types. I mean, they're not going to be persuaded, are they?
Well, we've both encountered that. We've all encountered that. And it's really, at some point you do have to kind of disengage because there's just, it's stuck in stupid, and to carry on with it just puts you in the same mode. One thing I guess that I'd pull back and ask about the James Randi phenomena, if you will, one of the things that it seems to me that he has done, and it's part of his appeal, these ruthless attacks, personal attacks, on scientists who really are caught unsuspecting of it. When I first got into Skeptico, that's one of the things that kind of motivated me, is that I felt like it was really kind of an unfair game. I mean, here's a guy who had brought hardball, dirty trick style politics to science. I mean, if he gets credit, he gets credit for doing that and having that really work, because a lot of us really like that hardball, dirty trick style, even if we don't admit we like it. You know, we like it and we kind of admire people who can get ahead by any means. Mm. But he really brought that to science. And they're really, I think these folks are really caught unsuspecting. I mean, I know, you know, Rupert Sheldrake and Dean Radin and some of the people I first talked to and I highly respect. I think they were really just unprepared for someone who would just have that kind of approach.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's always true. I think parapsychologists are shocked and taken aback when, you know, the skeptics charge and, you know, they just can't really believe that they make such extraordinary claims and exaggerations and distortions and so on. But, you know, there's an awful lot at stake here. I mean, there's a point here about Randy's prize. I have been trying to investigate a bit and trying to work out what goes on there, and it suffers from a terrible lack of transparency. I mean, you can't really see what's going on. I mean, Randy just sort of says, well, you know, lots of people have applied and nobody's got past the preliminaries. Well, what does that really mean? You know, it is a sort of a barrier, and it's very difficult to get past.
Right. So where do you plan to go with the book? and with your website as well. How is this going to evolve for you? I know it's available.
Yeah, it's all about information. I want to try to, I mean, I talked about a lot of the research, and I think that one of the things that really has been missing from this argument is the data itself. I mean, obviously that doesn't apply so much to the modern parapsychology, but certainly, you know, some of the previous psychic research into the sort of ghosts and apparitions and mediums and poltergeists and all these sorts of things, I think needs to be made more easily accessible. So it's very important to me to try and move that along. And I've been talking to the Society for Psychical Research, and they're going to make a lot of their early data, some of the interesting early articles by people like Frederick Myers and Hodgson and so on, available on their website for free, so that hopefully people will be able to go and download it. And I'll be providing links on my website. So, you know, it's about sort of trying to start a conversation, but also sort of nudging people to sort of check things out for themselves.
And tell us a little bit about how that's working out for you on your website, Paranormalia.
I mean, I wasn't sure how that was going to work out, but I find myself writing. I mean, I thought it was just going to be sort of little posts or sort of comments, but actually once I started writing, I sort of got quite involved. So they tend to be quite long essays, which is why I tend not to write as often as I'd like. But it's been fascinating, actually, because I get you know, a lot of comments and a lot of regulars turn up. And we've had some really interesting debates there in the comments threads. And in fact, I thought I might highlight some of them and just sort of revisit them to see what, you know, what's been said. And we have, you know, there are a few skeptics show up and very gamely make their points. And they tend to get mobbed a bit by the regular visitors. But, you know, they stick to their guns. And, you know, we do have some quite interesting discussions. But one of the things that comes up there a lot is, and one of the things that the regular visitors complain about when they're trying to get skeptics' attention, is that the skeptics won't engage with the research. You know, we're talking about things like, for instance, we're talking about mediums, so we talk about Leonora Piper, and then the skeptic will come back with all sorts of explanations that, you know, he thinks that, you know, we should take seriously. And then we say, well, actually, you know, we've looked at these explanations and they don't really stand up next to the data, but how will you know unless you read it, you know? And this is a constant problem. So this is one of the things I want to do, is try and make the data more easily accessible so that people really don't have an excuse for not getting to grips with it.
Well, it's a very interesting book, Randy's Prize, and I certainly wish you the best of luck with it, Robert. Thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex. I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Rob McLuhan for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show, including links to all our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to our forums where you can join a dialogue with other listeners and an email and Facebook link to me. Well, thanks for joining me as we wrap up my third year of doing Skeptico. And I have to tell you again what a great pleasure it is to do this show, to have this dialogue with all of you, and I certainly look forward to doing it for a long time in the future. I have a bunch of interesting shows coming up, so stay with me for that. And until next time, bye for now.